The seventh bowl. Well, this is the last seven of the last seven, so everybody can now start grinding in. Ready? The seventh angel poured out his bowl over the air, the place where the spirits are imagined to be, the evil spirits of the air. And a loud voice came out of the temple and from the throne saying, finito. It's over. Finished. Evil has been destroyed. And there are flashes of lightning, voices, peals of thunder, a great earthquake as has never been seen since people were on the earth. So great was the earthquake. The great city always Babylon, the great city was split into three parts and the cities of the nations fell and the great Babylon was remembered before God to make her drain the cup of the fury of his wrath. Babylon, the symbol for the oppressive state, the state that brought Israel into exile in Babylon in 587 and so on. And now the Babylon, I don't have to say to you, is clearly Rome, but I'll show it to you in a minute. The great city, whatever that might be for their generation, and it was Rome, for our generation, we've got to find it. And it's probably multifaceted, but the center of power in the earth of evil is destroyed. It's over. And every island fled away and no mountains were to be found. We've had all that before. And great hailstones, the seventh plague of Egypt, heavy as a talent, 100 weight, dropped on people from heaven till people cursed God for the plague of hail. So fearful was that plague. Expression, loud, etc. It is over. Earthquake such as never been seen. See it there? Never been seen since people were on the earth, so great was the earthquake. The language is taken directly from the book of Exodus in relation to the seventh plague. A greater storm of hail than had ever been known in Egypt since it first became a nation. This is typical dramatic literature. Daniel chapter 12 verse 1. This is going to be a time, and he's talking about his time, of course, 165 BC. This is going to be a time of great tribulation such as has never been seen since nations first came to the existence. Preachers love this kind of language. So everything's the worst it's ever been. And here it is. In those days, says Jesus in Mark's Gospel, there will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of creation until now and will never be. Same kind of apocalyptic literature, where, in other words, we're here talking about the final showdown between good and evil. And it will be different for each person, it'll be different for each group, it'll be different for each nation. And history will have to see it realized in the real historic circumstances that they're going through. This man's not talking about an apocalyptic battle at the end of time. He's talking about the apocalyptic battle that's going on in the heart of every human being and every generation. And in his generation, he's describing it in appropriate terms, which we'll now go straight on to look at in chapter 17. The author in chapter 17 gives us a flashback now and isolates one particular element of that judgment of God that covered earth and sea and sky and the whole thing and the air and the source of thing, and finally Babylon is centered. He focuses now on the destruction of Rome, meaning the destruction of, by God, by good, by the blood of the Lamb, of that power that crucified Jesus, that murdered Paul and Peter, and that is causing the persecution in the year 94 in that part of the world. The power has changed, and Rome is hardly the most powerful place in the world now, so we'd have to look elsewhere for that. But this source of power is destroyed. Let's just let it almost read for itself. Then one of the seven angels, going back, having the seven bowls, came and spoke to me, saying, here I will show you the judgment of the great harlot, the one who gives her favors out everywhere, prostitutes people and prostitutes her own life, drawing them in for the pleasures of, and we're talking about Rome, of the day, as seen by our prophet in its worst aspect, the values and the whole system of economic mercantile wealth that is wrapped up in that world system. the judgment of the harlot who is seated upon many waters, Mediterranean, basically, but the different seas and that where the Roman Empire had spread, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication. Kings of Lydia, king of Persia, the king of the Galatians, the king of Greece, the king of all the different ones that came in behind it, became part of it, accepted its value system, and put down their own subject peoples to be part of it. I mean, we can make parallels, can't we? But you can make them just as easy as I can to the communist world, or to the capitalist world, or to the British Empire world, or all the ways, insofar as they were ways, in which any particular group of people, for its own pride and wealth, puts down Sri Lanka and makes them all grow tea for the good of bushels and the empire and cricket and all those jolly good things that we all should enjoy. But subjects other people and doesn't even pay them a decent wage and so on and so on and so on. Here I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who is seated upon the many waters with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication and with the wine of whose fornication the dwellers upon the earth have become drunk. At the end of the first century, people have become drunk with the pleasures of the advantages of belonging to Rome. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. Some of the imagery there, if you go back to the book of Jeremiah, speaking of Babylon, he speaks of Babylon enthroned beside many waters. Waters, again, riverways, canals, oceans. It's to do with the only kind of empire they could have in those days, basically. It's mercantile, shipping, controlling the Mediterranean, I guess is the point. Babylonian throne beside many waters, rich in treasures, you now meet your end, the finish of all your pillaging. Or, again, Jeremiah, writing at the time of the destruction of his own city of Jerusalem, where Babylon is the great enemy. Babylon made the whole world drunk, and nations drank her wine, and then went mad. Babylon is suddenly fallen, says Jeremiah 51:7. So you see the imagery being used here? Now Babylon is Rome. What is it today? You've got to find out. We've got to find out. He carried me in a spirit into the wilderness, the place of deeper perception, the place of interiorization. I will take you into the desert and then speak to your heart. Hosea. Possibly a reference to the fact that the city has been turned into a desert. Don't know. Literature is always hard to be sure about. Literary criticism is a very delicate affair, but that image is possibly there. He took me into what was the great city and is now a wilderness. It may also be saying that. Isaiah 21.1, or verse 1, referring to the fall of Babylon, says, as whirlwinds sweeping over the Negev, the southern plains below Judah, comes from the desert, from a land of horror, a harsh vision has been shown me. The plunderer plunders, the destroyer destroys. Everything being devastated. Our prophet sees by intelligent, inspired perception that the system of mercantile supremacy and injustice upon which Rome's power was built cannot survive and must self-destruct from within. And do I have to spell out the implications for us today? They come obvious to many of us, but they're subtle. And the point I'm trying to make here all the time is that the book of the Apocalypse does not point to what our problems are. He's pointing to the problems of his world, which he had discerned. It's not a crystal ball. It's not a magic little thing where God has put words in there for every generation to find. If you think that passage is talking about Americanism or humanism or something, it's up to you to prove it and show it and do something about it. But the book of the Apocalypse isn't thinking what's going to happen in Australia in 1990. He's talking about his world, just as Isaiah's talking about his world and Jeremiah's talking about his world. But they're talking about it with the insight inspired by Revelation. And when they see their truth, if we are in touch with it, we then don't find our truth in there. But we have to find it inspired and enlightened by that. Let me continue. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast. Woman. We've already seen the beautiful woman. Eh? Now here's another woman. Here's the harlot. Here's the reversal of what woman should be. Here's the evil counterpart of the woman who's bringing forth Christ. This woman is seated on a scarlet beast, scarlet the colour of pomp and ceremony and wealth and luxury and economic power and all of that. A beast which was full of blasphemous names. It had 7 heads and 10 horns. And we've been through that, it's the 3rd time. The woman was clothed in purple and scarlet. Successful. Everyone wants to get their records. Everyone wants to be part of it. Bedecked with gold, bedecked with jewels and pearls. False divinity, the false glamour, the false glister. Holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her fornication. X-rated videos, etc., etc., etc. On her forehead was written a name of mystery, a name that needs discerning, this one, Babylon the Great. No one could accuse him of attacking Rome, could they? Babylon the Great, mother of harlots and of the earth's abominations. And I saw a woman drunk with the blood of the saints. Rome, glutted with the blood of Peter, Paul, Prudentiana, the early martyrs of Rome. Now, Polycarp and the nameless Antipas was mentioned in an earlier letter. The blood of the martyrs of their day in their world, glutted with the blood of that. These powerful, mighty, rich, well-dressed charioteers of the world. Grinding through the world with their great big bloody Wellington boots, going all over everybody, and everyone's acclaiming Roma, Roma, viva, while the ordinary people are getting trodden down, starving, etc. I saw a woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I myself will tell you the mystery of the woman. I'll explain it to you. And the beast with 7 heads and 10 horns that carries her. In spite of my little things, here it is. Explanation of that scene. The beast that you saw was and is not. You see what that's playing with? It's anti-God, it's the 6 and not the 9, it's the reversal. It was and is not. It's the exact opposite of Yahweh. Yahweh, the God of the poor. Yahweh, the God of the oppressed. Yahweh, the lover of the poor. Yahweh, the one who desperately wants to free people from oppression. This is the oppressor. This is the one that was and is not. And is to ascend from the bottomless pit. This beast, this demonic thing, and goes to perdition. It's not on its way up, it's going into absolute perdition, lost, finish. The dwellers of the earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to behold the beast, because it was and is not, and will be present. This calls for a mind with wisdom. We'll come back to that. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman is seated. 7 hills of Rome were quite as well known then as they are now. They are also 7 kings, 5 of whom have fallen. One is, and the other has not yet come. So it's nearly at the end. We're 5/7 of the way through. The Roman Empire isn't going to collapse tomorrow, says John. Don't expect to finish reading my thing and then it's going to be collapsed when you open your eyes tomorrow morning. But it's nearly done its dash. It's at the end. Now that's not literal. We don't have to add up all the emperors and find there were more than seven and there were just as many. No, he's just saying it's within one of finishing. It's soon. Soon. Now what's soon mean? But it's run out. And when he comes, he must remain only a little while. It's a little while. The judgment of God is not far from us. The liberation of Jesus in the agony is not far from him. Rome will go on for a long time. The Pharisees will go for a long time. The first church will be persecuted for a long time. But the liberation is at hand, is what it's saying. As for the beast that was and is not, it is the eighth. But it belongs to the seven and it goes to perdition. The eighth that belongs to the seven, remember? The one that was wounded we saw this morning and is healed, Domitian, Nero, another link. This is an eighth one, but actually it's one of the seven. It's one of the fullness. This is actually the, not literally, but this is Nero back again. Goes to perdition. Domitian's not going to last. He hasn't got the final say. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive the exercise of power as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are all the subject peoples that have said, yes, Caesar, you're right, Caesar, yes, come. These are of one mind and give over their power and the exercise of it to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And those who are with him are called the chosen and the faithful. And he said to me, the waters that you saw where the harlot is seated are the peoples and the multitudes and the nations and tongues, and the ten horns that you saw, they are the beast. They and the beast will hate the harlot. The people, the subject to Rome, will turn against Rome. They will break it down. They will make her, Rome, into a desert and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up like fire. It will corrupt from within. For God has put into their hearts to carry out his purpose and to be of one mind and to give over their royal power to the beast until the words of God shall be fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over all the kings of the earth. The power that is oppressing these people at the end of the first century, our author is simply saying, has been judged, will be judged, will go to perdition. Do not be afraid. Hold on to your faith. Endure in it. Don't let the persecution stop you from believing. Okay, that's all. Rushed, wasn't it, at the end there? But that's our journey. And we've come through to the final penetration of the thing. Rome will fall. The oppressor will go down. Tomorrow morning, we're going to find chapter 18, for those of you who want to look a little bit ahead. Chapter 18 is actually a lovely, incredibly marvellous redoing of chapter 17 with another form of art. In fact, if I had time, and had time with you, but I know I'm not going to do this, tomorrow's chapter 18 ought to be dramatised. See, this author is full of incredible stuff. Now, this is all put in a play, a lament. If you had the art, you'd need the music, the singers, the actors. He actually, in chapter 18, acts out chapter 17 with seamen and merchants. And I'm going to do it for you I'm not going to act at all, but I'm going to try to present it to you and then go back over the theme of what is the wine of the impure passion of Rome. What was the key sin of Rome, as our author sees it? What, in his view, prophetic as it is, was the key corrupting value system on which this whole powerful demonic system was built? He names it really clearly, and it's still with us. So we've got to try and look at it for ourselves too. Okay, thanks very much.